There is nothing we should be quite so grateful for as the last line of a poem that goes, when your own heart asks, be resolved, young samurai, and tell the world what you witness here today.
To know oneself, you must know the world. And so we tell stories of heroes to remind ourselves that we too can be great. That's an old sentence.
Yeah.
We're finishing with the same sentence?
We've come full circle.
We've come full circle.
Folks, I think folks at this point can now understand for themselves what it means to tell stories of heroes.
That's fair. That's fair enough.
Full circle plus one Steve.
You know what? I think we picked up an excellent addition on that last little... excursion.
You were in the first season, weren't you?
Oh yeah, but not at the beginning.
At the end.
Yes.
We did the same thing with this season.
Yeah.
We started off strong and then we brought Steve in
and kind of fell apart. Oh, nice. Well, you invited me here for some liquor, so I guess I'm the winner after all.
Winner chicken dinner.
Yeah. Hardly knew her.
Hey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, this will be our final episode of the series. So we did pull out a little bottle of something to celebrate. We have some sake. A Daiginjo Premium Sake. The rice, I am told, is polished to 50%.
Wow.
Yes.
Ooh.
Is the winner of Fine Sake Awards 5 years in a row.
Ooh.
It's a big deal.
You talk about that much better than when Casey and I tried to talk about wine on the Giants episodes. It's basically like, yeah, we drank this bottle of wine. It was $10. It was great. Have a nice day.
Let's crack this seal and pour up to celebrate.
The finishing of a creative project.
We did a thing.
I feel like, okay, like for context for the audience, if this is ever going to make it to the internet, like, we have started so many creative projects over the years. Like, constantly. Whether it's role-playing related, art related, drawing related, storytelling related. All of it. Like, we've started so many things that have never come
to... Roman?
Yeah.
Mm. This is a familiar story, yes.
That has never
happened
before. But like, and like, it's because I think we get so inspired by something and we just like full heart into it for so long and then our heart falls into something else and then we just go full bore onto that.
Yep.
And that's a rotation that you get when you get into your 30s.
30s.
Well, it's an unfortunate reality that being passionate about so many things typically prevents you from seeing something through to a completion. But not this time!
We did it, ladies and gentlemen!
Kanpai!
Kanpai! Oh, that's delicious. That rice goes down great.
50% of it.
Stop it, Steve. Oh, it's only 50% rice, Megan. I just said that. Were you not listening?
It's like I'm not even here.
Fair enough.
Anyways, welcome to a special edition of Mimic of the Five Rings on the It's a Mimic channel. I'm Steve, and with me today are Megan and Roman. In this episode, we're going to be sharing some of the tools we use to help build fun and engaging campaigns for the fourth edition of the Legend of the Five Rings RPG. But before we get into that, I'm curious. Do you guys have a favorite PC or NPC from one of the campaigns that we've run?
Ooh, do we want to roll the dice for this?
Nah.
I happen to have D10s.
Nah. Oh, well, if there's
on my person.
If there's D10s present.
So he's like, fuck it, I don't want to roll dice, but we're going to. All right.
I rolled a 6.
6, too.
I got a 3.
I got a rock. Okay, I'm going to roll off. 4.
5.
Okay, so you go first, Rome.
My favorite NPC from all of the L5R games that I have run happens to be the Black Queen. Also known as Daigatsu Chiguma. They were the villain who ran through the course of the majority of the games that I have run in the setting. She was the big bad in the last big arc that brought most people together. I've seen people die to her. I've seen people rise up to defeat her. Like, she was monumental in the story that I've told. And the player who created her initially ended up being my wife.
Hey-o.
Impactful.
And, like, she was used in my game, too. Like, she was the main big bad evil guy that they didn't know existed, but was just, like, in the undertones of. They were dealing with other things, but, like, Black Alien is not gone and has not disappeared in our world. And even though that she spanned over so many different eras that we've played in this campaign, she still exists.
Yeah, she's there lingering in the background, sort of festering, as it were.
Yeah.
She's not dead.
The Black Queen?
Yeah.
No. Oh. She was only sealed away.
Oh, damn.
Steve, were you not there at the last episode of the campaign we just played?
I have actually... No? Yeah. No, I have never played in a campaign where the Black Queen was present.
Yeah.
I skipped that story arc.
I also skipped the story where she was present, like in full form. Mm. The final battle was against her in the one campaign that I played where she existed.
Gotcha.
And like it was my and like I go next. It was my favorite PC partner who was the one that caged her and drew her into like the underwhelms, shall we say.
So who is your favorite PC?
Mine would have been Takara, who was built from the Wolf Clan, which was a homebrew clan that you're going to talk about later in this episode.
Spoilers!
But she... I really enjoyed playing her character because she was the kind of character that I built coming back to the game after being out of it for so long. And really... not feeling so full-hearted and wanting to engage, so I specifically built her to not be the center of attention, period.
How'd that work out for you?
She was supposed to fade into the black and fade into the darkness and just be there as a bushi to help people around, right? Anyway, she ended up attaching herself to another one of our PCs, one of our good friends played, and they ended up in one of the cutest romantic relationships I think that ever existed because no one really knew that it was happening. And part of it, I feel like, was because we were so awkward. It was awkward to play it at the role play it at the table. But mixed in with both of our characters were built not to fall in love. Having to build this relationship with another person that was also not built to fall in love, but you kind of love them, but they had this weird partnership that would come out every once in a while in like little conversations of, well, I'm never going to leave you, so we may as well just keep going. Or just little small pockets and undertones of the fact that they are in a partnership. And then eventually he got dragged into the ground and she panicked and said, nope, I can't live life without you. I will follow you. And then went and dragged him back. So, and their love story moved into the campaign that I played. And they were the quest givers for my next campaign that I ran as a DM.
Aw.
Yeah.
Adorable.
They had many, many childrens. So.
Yep. Lots of fucking.
Lots of fucking. Lots of babies. What about you, Stevie?
I've got two PCs that are pretty tight in favoritism for me, but I think I will also talk about the wolf that I played, which was one Kyushu Katashi, who was built to be this just tank of a man.
Mm-hmm.
Part of this was a bit of a playtesting element of romance content. I wanted to see if I could break his character.
Sure did.
And I did. He became almost like nigh untouchable. Like it was very, very difficult to do any damage to him. It was almost impossible to get him out of a defensive stance. He could basically walk into the middle of a crowd of enemies and just plant his feet and stand against the tide. But that's not necessarily what I love about the character. The character had probably one of the better sort of backstories that I've implemented into a character as to why they are, who they are, and do what they do. So while I, as a player, have never played in any games that touched on the Black Queen, my character was present at one of the major battles, I believe the battle that resulted in her being sealed away.
That would be the March of the Black Queen.
Yes, the March of the Black Queen. And he was betrayed by those in his company and basically thrown under the bus as a coward, and therefore was labeled as something called a...
Death Seeker.
Death Seeker. So basically the idea is, we're not going to cast you out of the clan, we're not going to make you a Ronin, but it is now your job to go and die honorably in the name of our clan. You need to throw yourself with abandon into every single situation and hope that you die in glorious battle,
mm-hmm.
which he had a very hard time with because Mans was a tank. Just nothing could bring him down. And eventually he ended up on this mission to scout the Mantis lands on a boat. which, when you are a large man in large armor, being on the boat is real risky. That is, in fact, how he met his end, was falling into water and sinking to the deepest, darkest depths. And yeah, it was just a fun character to play. He was sad very, day. Very sad. But it was just a fun character to play. He had a lot of layers. He was very conscious of the fact about having his armor removed because he used his skin as a tapestry. So he would tattoo himself with his greatest deeds to keep track of the things that he had done well and things he'd done poorly. So his great successes he tattooed on his chest, and his great failures he tattooed on his back. In sort of a symbolic way of gesturing that he wanted to leave the things that he had done wrong behind and move forward towards the things that he wanted to do well.
I'm just like watching Roman's face while you're explaining that, and he was just like, wow!
This was not something I talked about at the table. It was a background
motivation. Yeah.
This is the character that never took his armor off, yes. Right? The one that my character had like a small thing for, and then he...
Yeah. That's absolutely. Yeah. He was very private. Only let one other person see him with his armor off from like an old childhood friend.
Mm-hmm.
Because his achievements were not for boast. You did not want to make a big deal of the things that he had and had not done. He wanted it to be a personal record.
Hey, man, if you had not dove into that fucking well of a pool, we could have had something.
Could
have.
But
I mean, it would have been 5 seconds long because she did have a love of her life who was not you. But you know what? We could have had something.
We could have had some fun. You know. What? But then you had to go save your childhood friend.
I did, who happens to be my greatest love.
No. My childhood friend.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
Yeah. I had to save Kankuro, who then went on to serve my other favorite character. But that's another story.
And on that note, let's get into the meat and potatoes of this episode.
All right, so we're going to be talking about a couple, as we mentioned, things that we utilize as DMs and players when we're playing this game to make it a little bit easier for us to kind of follow along with some of the rules and guidelines. Because as we've talked about, and as those who have been listening from the beginning know, L5R is a game that is very dense and filled with rules. So having many ways to kind of keep track of those rules and mechanics makes things run a little bit smoothly and makes players at your table a little bit more ease of mind because they have a couple of references that they can go through, right? So one of the things that Roman created for us that ours, it's kind of a homebrew-ish thing, is the Shinosuke's Guidance Cheat Sheet, is what we call it. Do you want to explain to people why it's called Shinosuke's Guide? So it is, for the people at home, it basically explains the complex and simple action breakdowns, stances, and the combat flow. So this is all about combat and all those pieces. Why is it called Shinosuke's Guidance?
So it's called Shinosuke's Guidance because within the game, there was a great Nozumi sensei named Shinosuke, Honshu Shinosuke, who passed on the various teachings of the pure, pure style of many blades and constantly was just drilling to his students, you know, like, know the basics, know how things work, and once you know those things, then you can begin to implement bigger and greater tactics. So with that in mind, I used Shinosuke as a way of presenting that information in sort of a cute and fun way. So I took all of that information, I wrote it into a shorthand that was easy enough to understand, and then I tried to make it all fit on one page so that I could print it out and put it in front of people. So it breaks down the stances and how they work. It breaks down how to roll initiative. It breaks down all of the actions that you can take during combat. What is a simple action? What is a free action? What is a complex action? How do each of those things sort of stack up with each other?
Mm-hmm.
What is the role necessary to make an attack roll? What is the role necessary to make a damage roll? And so on and so forth. At the bottom of the sheet, it also has a couple of supplementary mechanics that we're going to end up exploring a little bit later on. But it was just a way of trying to make it easier for people. Because we've been playing the game for a long time, and still, because the rules are so dense, it's difficult to keep track of all of it all the time.
Yeah, there's more than one time I can, like, reimagine when we're playing and sitting at doing a combat at a table and someone's like, how do I calculate how far I can run? How do I calculate my movement? How do I calculate my TN? How do I calculate these pieces? What do you mean I have resistance? What does that mean?
Literally every time we sit down to create characters, I forget how to calculate my armor TN.
Oh my god.
Every time.
Every time. And then I'm like, but if I have a resistance, what does that mean? Like, what does that do to my TN? Nothing, Megan.
Nope.
It's just like, I'm like, oh, okay.
And that's not to scare anybody away from the system, because, again, once you have it in front of you, It's easy enough to remember it, but you're trying to remember all of these crunchy mechanical things along with all of these nuanced social things. So removing one aspect of it, it was just my way of making it easier for people to focus on what I feel is the more important part of L5R, which is the setting and the storytelling.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, it's not your classic role-playing game where you get in a battle every session, right? You're not hitting all three pillars every session. Sometimes you'll have a session that is a very long battle because it's required, and battle in L5R takes a long fucking time. And then sometimes you'll have a whole session that is literally just having a conversation or going to a ball and having those social interactions, right? We've gone episodes without combat, period. Yep. Which means even people who are veterans who have played this game for an extended period of time are so used to rolling their characters from a social standpoint and like point of view that switching back into combat is kind of like, I don't remember which button fights.
How do I light punch?
Like, it's just so it builds into the fact that that's how the way the system is built. The system is built for those social interactions more than it is for the combat. It's there because it's there. Yeah. But I do find the sheet very successful and useful. I don't know if you guys can agree from your player experience. Steve, did you find this sheet useful for you?
Yeah, no, it's really nice to have it on hand. Often when you're sort of in between scenes, so whether the GM is running something for somebody else in the party or whatever, you know, you're paying attention, but also you're thinking about, or at least I'm thinking about, what am I going to be doing next?
Mm-hmm.
What was I doing when was last my turn? Where is that scene going? What do I need to be doing? What do I need to do? And sometimes that's the opportune moment for me to just basically go like, oh, I want to do that, but I forget. And obviously, you know, Roman or whoever else is currently running a scene with somebody. So I can't just be like, hey, how do I do this again?
Yeah.
Because like, rude.
so fucking rude.
Minor honor loss. But like,
get out of the table, Steve.
So having a little like sheet, I could just basically pull up and go like, oh yeah, like, that's what this does. That's how I can, you know, finagle that. And then if there's any last little, like, finishing touches when it comes back around to me to have my moment, I can clarify those. But, again, having the basics, having the general idea of how a scene will play out depending on what kind of scene it's going to be is really nice to just have on hand so anybody can look at it. I mean, you look at your average board game these days, almost every single one comes with a little card. The little card will be like, these are the breakdowns of your turn. These are the things you can do. And like, sure, it might not go into like the fine details, mm-hmm. but you've got it all right there. So that way, like when you're learning or bringing new people into it, they've got that little quick like reference sheet. This is the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like D&D, other role-playing games have cheat sheets that exist, right? Yep. But I remember when I was going to go DM my first game with people who have never played L5R before, I went to Roman being like, the one thing I am not comfortable teaching people is combat, because I'm not as well versed in it as I feel like I am with other role-playing games and systems, because in L5R we don't do it that often.
Sure.
And so I was like, I was not feeling very confident, and he's like, I got you. And then 2 days later, this sheet showed up, and he was like, here you go. I'm like, oh, thanks, BB. I go teach now.
Yeah.
Another item that can be used, which is used in most role-playing games, is what we call, of course, the DM screen cheat sheet. So this does exist for L5R. There is one that exists for 4th edition, which you guys know is the one that we're talking about the most within this podcast platform. But it is impossible to find because 4th edition is no longer in print and no longer in rotation. So when I went to go start to DM my first game, I did not have access to just going online and buying a 4th edition DM screen to help me. And for those of you who don't know what one is, figure your life out. But at the end of the day, it kind of gives you what weapon damage looks like, status effects look like, and a little bit of combat aspects as well, what honor losses might look like, how to have like social interactions. So those basic things that if you just need to quickly reference what prone looks like, or what, you know, falling off a cliff would look like, what fall damage would be. Like, this is kind of like, again, where you can, as a DM, have a quick look and a quick glance and be able to figure that out for your team instead of having to flip through the book, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I was blessed enough that Roman made me one when I went to go be a DM, because I was like, I really need one, but I didn't want to pay $150 one from Amazon that may or may not show up from someone randomly on the other side of the world. You know what I mean?
Valid.
But even then we had to edit a bunch of stuff on it when we printed it out and, that kind of stuff. Cause like, again, the system has changed over the years. And
we've homebrewed some things as well, like honor gains and honor losses,
and how they work, like, and how what that math looks like has shifted and changed.
Yeah.
And what certain actions your characters could take, and what that honor loss looks like.
Yep.
Right. So I remember changing all of those numbers, and they're like written in with this fine pen. I'm like, I'm never going to be able to see that, but thank you.
They're there.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, I feel like any DM who's wanting to roleplay a game or start off in any kind of like system, a DM screen is phenomenal.
Yep.
It is nice to have all the books accessible to you or like have the internet with you. That's fine. But at the end of the day, even when I played D&D the other day with you guys, which is a system I understand way more than I understand L5R, I still have to fucking check a DM screen. Or look up what Grapple is. Don't laugh at me, internet, because everyone knows I hate Grapple. But
oh, how strange.
I still have to look that stuff up.
Huh.
Right? And, like, Roman has to look it up, too. And he's been DMing L5, like, GMing and storytelling L5R for over a decade.
Again, it reduces mental load.
Yeah.
Yep.
It is one less thing that I need to actively have cooking in my brain, and one thing that I can say, yep, I already have this here. I can look at it quick. I can make a decision. And then I can get back to making the important decisions. Like, are these two characters going to make out at this dance? Or is this other character going to challenge them to a duel?
That's fair.
Yep.
Yeah.
Progressing the story.
Makes it a little bit easier for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And the last thing I want to talk about that makes your life a little bit easier as a storyteller or a player is something that we created, which was the reference cards. So these are things like if you wanted to duel someone, a card will have all the steps required to follow through with a duel. Or a game term cheat sheet. So whether you're calling someone Sama or San or Chan or, you know, using those acronyms, Mr., Mrs., Sir. Like it gives you those like polite how to have a conversation with somebody. So again, you're not having to have that mental load as a player of, I'm sorry, I don't know what to call you.
Yes.
I don't know what your proper term is, right?
Yeah, it all plays into that professional courtesy element. It's just putting the onus a little bit more on yourself than...
Yeah, and it's nice to have it too. Like if you want to start actively, you know, just understanding the system. Like I remember when I first started playing, I would have that one with me all the time and be like, now I just choose, like, now I'm playing a character that's calls everyone Sama because she's like, whatever. You're better than me at something is her term. So
hey, fair enough. Whereas my character is, I'm probably better at you than everything.
Yeah. Very opposite.
Yes.
It's fine. Another card that we have is the glory and infamy gains. So glory and infamy, I find we're starting to utilize more in our gameplay. And I find that this card is very handy to have. Again, it kind of gives you a little bit of a reference to an act that you may do and what that would give you in glory or, you know, make yourself infamous in some way, shape, or form. Another one that's fun to have is the Code of Bushido right there on hand. I find this one to be very handy because you can actually remember what your character's is and what you built your character around. Because I find with L5R, you do kind of choose one or two of these aspects of Bushido, and that's kind of what you're going forward with. And then, like, one or two that you might forget, and then ones that you care or don't care about, right? So just having that on hand is very handy. One that goes along with the Shinosuke's guidance, so, like, the battle sheet system that we have, was the stance cards. And these are the most helpful ones I had ever had, especially when we played at the game that had over 10 people in it.
Oh, yeah.
And again, to Steve's point, you're not going to stop gameplay to be like, what are the stances? So for anyone who's listened to our episode about how to have a battle and how that worked, basically at the beginning of combat, you choose a stance, which gives you buffs or debuffs in different areas of movement, combat, my ability to cast a spell, all these pieces, right? And so knowing how to pick your stance makes your turn make sense. So having that on hand is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like I think out of all of these cards, that's the one that I use the most is the stance cards. So that I can go into combat with a little bit more of a easier mind of not having to stop combat to re-ask what is what, right?
Agreed. And since it's set at the beginning of the round as well, especially at a 10-person table, you know, at the beginning of the round, you're like, I'm in fire stance. And then, like, eight people's turns later, it's like, all right, it's your turn. What stance are you in? You're like, oh, right, it's on my card right in front of me.
I put
it on
the card table. Down, yeah.
It's on the table. I'm in fire stance. But without that, sometimes you're like,
As a GM, I was smart enough with a smaller table of like four or five to write down what people's stance were in. Because, sure. Like, again, it's always rotating, like,
yep.
Who's going first, who's going last so far. But I think that's a great idea when you're a table of like 8 or 8 to 10 and you just can't keep track of that quickly. Having the card in front of you is so handy.
Yeah. And well, one of the stances literally changes the order that people go in. If you go into void stance, it's going to change your initiative. So like having a way to track that easily and keep track of it, the cards are invaluable in that regard.
100%.
Yeah. Speaking of cards, there are a couple other ones that we like to use on a regular basis that are not so much mechanic heavy, but are a little bit more... what's the right word?
Supplemental.
Supplemental. Yeah. Fluffy. They add to the game.
It's a little bit of context.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Just sort of like, it draws you into the world. It gives the players, different ways to interact, and like a little bit more agency over or ownership over their characters. And on that note, the first one is sort of, these character cards that, Roman started making for us. And part of our character creation process is finding a image of the character that we're playing that best represents sort of the idea that we have behind that character. And then Roman will take it, put it into a card generator, and assign sort of a grouping of stats that generally sort of break down what your character is about. They're sort of like major traits, who they are, what they do. And it's just a nice little sort of snapshot of what your character is about. It's kind of fun to put a face to the name. And sometimes it sort of gives people a better idea of like who they're talking to, because it can be very easy to look across the table and see, oh, there's my friend that I've known for a decade, and instead be able to look over and be like, ah, yes, I am talking to
this person,
you know, this person, this gigantic crab bushi, or this very, you know, thin, svelte, you know, crane courtier. It allows just that a little bit of extra immersion in the world and gives people a point of reference about who's there and what's going on.
Yeah, I think they tie in nicely because, of course, Elphivar was originally a card game.
Yes.
So it makes sense that we make characters that are on cards.
Yeah. And they're sort of styled after those cards as well.
Exactly. Right. It was a smart idea.
Yeah. Like, no, I love it.
And I think that they translated well to online gameplay. And I found that more often than not, when we play on Discord or other any online platforms we were playing on, we would post the character cards of the NPCs we were talking to.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
And I found that super helpful because there'd be times where like we'd have an episode and we wouldn't play for 2 or 3 weeks later. And I'd be like, I don't remember who we were talking to in the last episode. And I would literally go into that chat, look at all the cards, and remember all the people that I was talking to, and then rewrite their names down.
Yeah.
So it was a great historical snapshot of the different people we were interacting with.
No, it's really, really nice to have that log of, these are the people that are relevant to this campaign. I won't lie. I am terrible at remembering character names.
Oh, 100%.
They just don't stick in my brain. You know, they're all, Japanese traditional names for the most part. And so, like, a lot of it just sort of slips off my brain because they're not.
Well, even in any role-playing game, I barely remember people's names.
I can do better with more familiar things.
That's fair.
Generally, for me anyways. But just because there's sort of that lack of frame of reference for me to a certain degree with, you know, like, familiarity sense, I have a harder time.
That's fair. I mean, to be honest, I forgot who your character was, even though we almost had a thing.
Fair. So.
Wow! Heartbroken.
Cold-blooded.
What is your favorite thing about the cards you created for characters, Roman?
I love all the things that you guys just mentioned. Like, it makes it so easy for people to create a connection with the name. It's sometimes it's easier to remember a face than it is to put a face to the name.
Yeah.
And so if I'm just rattling names at you guys, there's no face associated with it, you're going to forget them. If you see the face, the name is then going to stick a little bit easier. I've loved watching characters evolve through their cards.
Yes.
One thing that I do is, so a holdover from the original Legend of the Five Rings trading card game was a keyword called experienced. Mm. So when you see a character with the experienced keyword, it is them at a different snapshot of their life. One of the characters that I wrote as a self-insert in the world is a Togashi Izao. He is a tattooed man who ends up joining the Imperial Archivists and ends up becoming the lead Imperial Archivist for the Empress. And whenever I write you guys, you know, letters in between arcs, normally they are signed Togashi Izao, but on his cards, I've gotten to sort of watch this character develop and grow. And it has mirrored my own experience and my journey through L5R. And the unfortunate reality is that he is probably old enough to be retiring now. So I'm going to have to, like, slip him out and find a new GM insert PC. And
a progeny.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of sad, but also, you know, it's a beautiful thing. But my favorite thing is watching the progress and watching people give me, hey, you know, your character went through this thing. What is the next art that you have for me? What are the keywords that you want to see shown on your character card? Who is this person now? And then to look at those four or five cards in order to see that story progressing, that always really fills me with a sense of wonder.
Yeah, not only that, but like even when you're having that conversation of trying to figure out that historical data, we have all these character cards on a drive.
Yep.
And like separated by clan and who they are. And like I remember rocking up like just the other week and you guys like, are these two characters brothers? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. And then you turn the laptop around to show me their pictures and I'm like, no. Because I'm a visual person. I'm not a names, numbers person. I'm a show me the picture and I'll tell you yes or no.
Yeah.
Tell me what character they played and I'll figure that out for you.
Same.
So
yeah.
Very helpful.
And finding the art is a lot of fun too. I think it's one of my favorite parts of the character creation process. Like it's kind of like the, you know, create a character screen in Skyrim or any other RPG where you're just like, oh yes, this hairstyle or oh, these kinds of robes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do have some Photoshop expertise as well. So like sometimes it'll be like, oh, this guy is exactly what I pictured, but he's wearing blue robes and I need him to be in green because he's a mantis. So into Photoshop they go, select the robes, change the hue, ta-da. He looks like a mantis.
I did that with my unicorn picture. I was like, yeah, I'm going to turn this blue-purple. Thanks very much.
No, I've done that with a unicorn as well. I think it was yellow robes and I turned them purple. And I'm like, yep,
done.
Beautiful. I like it. So those are a lot of fun. Like I said, it just gives you a little bit more familiarity with the characters, both PCs and NPCs. And the other type of card that we quite often use is called a plot twist card. We get these dealt out at the beginning of a game. We've had a number of different variations on this system, but basically at the core, it is just an opportunity for us to affect something outside of our character's control. So something is happening. It is important enough to us as players that we're like, this really needs to succeed, or this is really bad. We need to do something to stop this from happening, because if we don't, we're screwed.
Yeah.
And like, there's nothing that we as characters can do. We need some kind of luck or divine intervention of some sort.
Yeah.
And so these cards have a number of different values on them and quotes on them that are sort of vague hints that can be interpreted either by us or the GM to alter a current situation that we're in. And generally, when we decide that we're going to spend one of these cards, there will be one that is face up on the table and then an array of ones that are face down. And if the one that is face up doesn't quite suit our needs, we do have the opportunity to pay karma, which I'll get into it in a minute, which is sort of accrued. It's an accrued resource. I'll, again, talk about that in a second, to flip them over. And which gives us additional information because not all of the cards are necessarily beneficial. In fact, there is one array of cards that we are very familiar with called Flanked by Nightmares, which only ever results in bad things.
In terrible, terrible, terrible things.
Actually, that's a lie. I believe we've used it once to our benefit. It was a very specific situation.
I think it's when we use it against someone else.
Yes.
I think that's why.
Yeah, but generally, it is bad juju. You do not want to pull up Flanked by Nightmares. And I believe there are more of those cards than anything else in the deck.
Yeah.
But they'll have quotes like, you prove your trustworthiness, or you line up the perfect shot, or there'll be like a quote from a character at the bottom that says something like, the plague is unnatural, created not by nature, but the hand of man. I will see every trace of it purged from this world or die in the attempt. And you can interpret that quote however you want to. And when you choose the card, you can pitch it to the GM. And it's up to that GM to decide what they want to do with it. And it results in some interesting plot twist moments where when one thing would have happened, it gets turned on its head and it takes the story in a completely different direction. It's just an additional way that players can interact with the game and affect the outcome of major plot points that could otherwise have gone completely awry.
Yeah.
Do you have any favorite cards? Plot twist cards?
I love Flanked by Nightmares.
As a GM, you would.
You would.
Absolutely.
If you're not getting flanked, you're not having fun.
Fair enough. I like the fact that you kind of took it one step further in this last kind of campaigns we've couple play, these last couple of campaigns that we've played in, where you created plot twist cards using our old PCs.
Yes, the guidances.
The guidances. So we can now, in that randomization of pulling these cards to help us with our future prospects and future characters, are now coming from the characters that we once played.
Yes.
Which I think is a very, very interesting way to, one, make it a little bit more intimate and a little bit more personal. And it's always fun when you flip a card and you see your old character's art sitting there.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, my character took guidance from this person at one point, or like just thought of this person and helped them advance further. And it's just always that like aha moment of like, I built this person.
Yeah.
And
it's nice to see them be represented in that way, especially as the game progresses in time and those characters are no longer
around,
whether they be retired or dead.
My last one, I think, is finally dead. I think she's finally gone. Like, yeah. She was around for way too long.
But the other cards are all referencing old cards from the card game.
Yeah.
Which is also really cool because I played that game. Roman played that game. Megan did not play that
game. Hard pass on card game.
But it is nice to see some of the iconic art get like recycled back in and used for these cards that Roman has created for the game. Even Flanked by Nightmares is a classic artwork that's kind of cool to see it come up when it does.
Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. And then I do believe I promised an explanation of karma. So karma is basically Roman's way or the GM's way of rewarding players for being on time, remembering mechanics that a player or himself have forgotten, you know, really, really inspiring role play. Basically, it's inspiration.
I would say it's inspiration.
It's basically inspiration, but it's bankable. So basically, there are a list of things that you can spend your karma on, one of them being revealing plot twist cards. But there are a number of other things that you can basically use it towards to gain additional information or, you know, what else? Like, there are certain ways to modify dice rolls when you are, you know, feeling a little bit behind or you're low
or out of void points. Yeah.
You know, and like, it's just a nice little addition. So because you are playing along and you are helping your GM, you are making the game be better, you get this as a reward for having that interplay at the table.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, basically it is a take on inspiration.
Yeah. It's a take on inspiration that an inspiration is used in most different role-playing systems in one way or another, right? It's kind of like giving your characters a boon or another stat to utilize when their stats are not going to help them through the thing. Right. And I like the fact that karma, because it is a homebrewed mechanic that's kind of been created for us, it's changed each game we have played.
Yes.
And it has evolved with us as players because it became too overpowered when we would bank it and then use it in one session. So then the next round or the next campaign, it would be played in such a way that we could only use it for certain aspects to kind of limit the banking aspect.
Well, it grew as you guys grew, right? Yeah. When you guys started to understand the game more and understand what your characters could do and understand who your characters were when you were creating them, you didn't need the support of karma as much because you were engaging with the system, you were engaging with the society that the game runs in. Like, you guys were playing with each other, and therefore you didn't need karma as a safety net.
Yep.
Karma exists as a way, yes, of rewarding players for being fantastic, but also as a way of elevating players when they're struggling.
Yep. Yep.
And now, correct me if I'm wrong here as well, but credit where it's due, I believe karma for sure. And then were the fake cards also something that was introduced to us originally by our first GM?
Yes. So the fake cards and the karma mechanic, as well as the character cards, were presented to me by the first GM that showed me Legend of the Five Rings. And I could run a whole episode on my feelings about this person. But the most important parts of it boil down to the fact that they opened me up to a setting and a world and gave me so many tools to allow me to share this thing that I love with so many people. Mm-hmm. And regardless of what any of my other feelings might be, I will always be grateful to them for that.
Absolutely. I mean, those campaigns that we ran introduced us to the setting, gave us an idea of what it was all about, gave us a lot of tools to build from and work out of. And I think, yeah, everything else aside, does deserve some credit for setting us on this path and allowing us to build and grow from that point to where we are now.
100%.
Yeah, I feel every GM or storyteller or DM we have operated with has given us one extra piece of themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
That we take with us into the next game that we play or the next game that we GM, right? Yep. Like, I stole so many things from Adam when I went to go play Elphavar, even though I've only experienced D&D with Adam. Like, I took a lot of, like, the pieces and the things that I learned from him as a GM and brought them into Elphavar.
Yep.
Took a lot of the things that I learned from Roman and brought them into Elphavar. I didn't use karma with my group, period, because I just thought it was one extra mechanic that wasn't necessarily needed because they were just learning the system.
Totally.
And instead, like, I just kind of spoke it to them as, like, this is just inspiration. And, like, so just took away, again, that mental load of this is just another mechanic I have to learn how to use. No, I'm giving you inspiration. Because it's a word they understood.
Yes.
Right? And so we just build it and adapt it to our players, to your point, Roman, and how, like, karma and inspiration is taken from other DMs and other GMs, but we adapted it to us as players in our group, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So before we move on to the last piece we're going to talk about today, which is a little bit more homebrew items. So we talked about Shinosuke's guidance cheat sheet, which is an example of, like, you know, showing people how to do complex actions, simple actions, and just combat breakdown and whole. The DM screen, obviously, anyone who's played a role-playing game knows what that is. Reference cards that we use, character cards that we use, plot twist cards we use, and karma is a homebrew item. Which one is your favorite piece?
Are we rolling?
No, just answer.
I like the character cards.
You like
the
character cards?
I really like the character cards. It roots me in the world. It gets, like... Because, like I said, I have a terrible, terrible mind for remembering names.
Mm-hmm.
I literally, the other day, we were at a group gathering with a bunch of friends, and I went to introduce an old friend of mine who I've known forever. I was at her wedding, and I blanked. And I stared at her and was like, and this is... like, I just, it's just, that's how my brain does not compute names well.
Yeah.
Especially if I don't use them, like, on a regular basis.
Fair enough.
But faces I'm very good with. Like,
yeah. You're a visual person.
I'm a visual person. So having the faces associated with the people that we interact with, like, I have scrolled through our old chat logs of, like, characters being introduced. I'm like, I don't remember that was that guy's name, but I absolutely remember who he is, what he did, how he affected my character in the scenario that we were playing in. Because that face is associated with those things, not the name.
Fair enough. Love it. Roman, what's your favorite one?
The DM screen is my Bible.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there are things on that screen that I could probably recite from memory.
Yep.
When I'm half a bottle of whiskey deep, I really don't want to have to.
That tends to happen.
Again, there are things that I would rather be focusing on when I am impassioned and I am present and I am there with the people and watching them pour their hearts out that I don't want to have to go and thumb through a book. The beauty of the DM screen is that it is so customizable.
Yep.
You get a 4-panel piece of cardboard, you throw some line paper on it, and you write down the information that you feel is most important to allow you to run a good game. And everything else, you let go and let God.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when we built my GM screen for when I did the L5R campaign, and they were like, do you need this? I'm like, no. And we just, like, took it out, and, like, we did not copy that over. We put something else in that I felt like I would need, right? So I would say as a GM or a storyteller, I would definitely do DM screen. I was not big on DM screens, even when we did the D&D campaign the other day. I went and bought one because I didn't have one for D&D for a long time because I was just like, I have my books. I don't need this shit. And I'm like, no. And now that I did the L5R one, I'm like, I'm just going to spend the fucking $10 and get a real one, right?
Yep.
But as a player, Shinosuke's Guidance is my bread and butter because, again, the combat happens so infrequently within this system that it's such a nice thing to have with you. One, because I don't like looking like an idiot. So if I don't know something, it's a piece of paper that I can be like, oh, that stance does this, great. And I don't have to ask that question and the risk of looking stupid.
Yeah.
Even though I'm playing at a table with people that I know and love and care about me and don't give a shit about whether I know something or not, it gives me that peace of mind that I'm not going to look like an idiot at the table that day.
Fair, yeah.
So, but I am a visual person. I like art, so I like the character cards. But when it comes to mechanics,
I love it all.
But like mechanics, I need those in front of me or I'm going to die in a fire. So,
yeah. For those of you interested, a lot of this information is going to be available on the Patreon. copies of Shinosuke's guidance, copies of the stance cards, and copies of the reference cards, along with the fate decks, so that you guys can use them in any of your role-playing games. They are not setting dependent, with the exception of, you know, the reference materials, but the fate cards are something that you could use in any of your games, be it Legend of the Five Rings, or Dungeons & Dragons, or any other game where you like to tell stories and give your players a little more agency. And now for our final section of this episode.
And the series.
We will be discussing what goes into building a clan. More specifically, we will be discussing what went into building the Wolf Clan. For centuries, the Kami Ryoshin was thought to have died at the dawn of the Empire. The reality is that his broken body fell to the earth like that of his siblings. But he was too weak to travel the Empire to be reunited with them. Hundreds of years later, a young Seppen Shugenja named Honshu would stumble across his resting place, become Ryoshin's first follower, and eventually, the father of the Wolf Clan. Hundreds of years later, a young Seppen Shugenja named Honshu would stumble across his resting place, become Ryoshin's first follower, and eventually, the father of the Wolf Clan. His twin sons Genju and Suichi were trained by the enlightened Nozumi Kensai Sakuhin, who cared for them in their father's absence. Master Sakuhin sent them on a pilgrimage for their Genpuku, so that they would learn the ways of the Empire and hone their skills. This 3-year pilgrimage would shape both boys, their eventual creed on what their clan would become, a place for samurai whose value and worth are ignored by those around them. The reign of the Honshu Kyodai would last for only a year until tragedy befell them. However, from this tragedy would rise the third and greatest daimyo of the Wolf, Honshu Hoshi. Hoshi was the secret third-born son of Seppen Honshu and a geisha that he fell in love with. Hoshi spent much of his youth unaware of his heritage, mingling freely with men and women of all clans and social status. He painted what he dreamed of, unknowing that he was painting visions of the future. After his brothers abdicated the championship and his lineage was brought to light, he was elevated to Wolf Clan champion and for the rest of his life built tight bonds with samurai from all over the empire, and even some of the Gaijin in other lands, accepting anyone who proved to be loyal and willing to embrace his vision of unity and inclusivity. The Wolf's duty is twofold: to destroy monsters outside the Empire and create heroes from within. They see the world with eyes unclouded by preconceived notions and choose samurai for their worth more than their value. The Wolf colors are silver, gold, grays, blacks, and whites. The Wolf Clan believe firmly in bonds of brotherhood and are most willing to promote and reward samurai of note. This has allowed them to grow in size and reputation over the years, becoming one of the larger minor clans in the empire. The families of the Wolf include the Honshu, the Kyushu, the Orihara, and the Miku. The Honshu are descended from Seppen Honshu himself and endorsed by the Kami Ryoshin. Honshu samurai seem to have a natural connection to the flow of the universe. Most have a propensity to become Shugenja, and all those of Honshu blood bear the golden hairs and eyes of their founder. Many view these physical traits as otherworldly. The Kyushu are bold, brazen, and firm in their resolve. Kyushu samurai are known to stand by their ideals to a fault. They are hearty and resilient samurai who temper their body and minds for the arts of war. Many Kyushu without Shugenja talent find themselves studying with various monastic orders or enlisting as scouts, as a lean lifestyle tends to be to their liking. The Orihara are the least like their kin. They overflow with charm and cunning. Tracing their bloodline back beyond their founder would find ties in both the Crane and Scorpion clans. The Orihara are storytellers, mediators, matchmakers, and lovers of games, serving as the diplomats and courtiers of the Wolf. The Miku are the Stone Wolves, and stand firmly as the clan's last line of defense. Brutal training and the unorthodox landscape of Honshu-mura led to the hearty samurai who do not tire, even when facing unbearable odds. The Miku act as the soldiers and bodyguards of the clan, most choosing to study in the infamous 36 Stance Dojo. This is the clan that I created when I first decided that I was going to run a Legend of the Five Rings game. My first L5R game was the first Wolf Court, where Honshu Genju and Honshu Suichi decided to invite samurai from all of the clans that they had spent time with during their Genpuku back to their home to entertain them, to curry favor, and to try and impress upon them that they were samurai worthy of respect and note. From that point, the Honshu brothers spawned something that has taken control of a large portion of my life when it comes to role-playing games. Their current clan champions are a council of wolves, five individuals who work together to ensure that the wolf function in the various realms that the wolf find themselves in. There is a political leader, there is a military leader, there is a social leader. They act like something of a senate or a, you know, a house of commons, and they all function together to allow the wolf to prosper as a clan. And they have been probably the biggest passion project of my life for the better part of a decade.
So at the end of the day, what was some of the things that were like, what was the inspiration that you used to create the wolf, and why the wolf?
So the biggest inspiration for the wolf were my own brothers.
Yeah.
And a video game that I played a lot with my youngest brother growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a Super Nintendo fighting game called Fatal Fury. And the two main characters of that game are the Bogard brothers, Terry and Andy Bogard. They are known as Hungry Wolves, mm-hmm. right? And there is a anime for that game. And in that anime, the character's dad dies and their master sends them on a pilgrimage to try and learn things about themselves. And so one brother goes off and he learns to fight one way, and another brother goes off and he learns to fight another way. And then the brothers come back together, and it is in that return together that they sort of challenge each other and elevate each other to become better and stronger. And growing up, yeah, my younger brother and I played a lot of Fatal Fury. So it was one of us would play Terry Bogard and one of us would play Andy Bogard. And that rivalry between us both as brothers and as people elevated both of us. And it's something that elevates us to this day.
Can't confirm. All you do is fight.
And you know what? I don't think that I would try as hard if I didn't have my younger brother constantly pulling at my shadow and reminding me, hey, I'm catching up. Hey, I'm a step ahead of you. Hey, now you're in my shadow. We're always sort of clawing to see which one of us can stand in front of the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Not because we're trying to be better than each other, but because we're trying to protect each other. I want to be better than my younger brother so that my younger brother doesn't have to worry if he falls.
Mm-hmm.
So that he knows that somebody's going to be standing in front of him to take the blows. And that's a lot of what he does for me as well, is when I'm in a position where I don't think I can pick myself up, he's the first person to stand in front of me and put a hand out and say, hey man, get up, let's keep going. And a lot of that sense of camaraderie and brotherhood is what I wrote Genju and Suichi around. And it's a lot of what I base the wolf on.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very rare that you take a very specific inspiration from your life and build something that's so successful in representing that. And I think the wolf did a very good job of doing that for you.
Yeah. Like the reason that I chose wolves over anything else is because even within L5R, the idea of a hound or the idea of a dog is supposed to sort of symbolize what a Ronin is, right? Like, oh, this mongrel, this mangy, this, you know, undesirable. But the reality is that the hound, the wolf, the dog is a hunting pack animal, is a community animal, is an animal that
exists in perseverance.
Precisely. Yeah. They're strong and resilient and
loyal,
right? They work together to accomplish things that cannot be accomplished by themselves. The idea of the lone wolf is, you know, that entity is sent out to die, because only with community can wolves really thrive together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, that being said, when talking to folks about homebrewing your own clan, how do you start and go about going to create your own clan? Like, there are so many different options within the L5R landscape as there is. The wolf, I do feel, fits a very specific need. So what are some important pieces to consider when developing your own clan?
Understanding the need.
Yeah.
Understanding the place that your clan plays within the empire. Because every clan exists because the emperor or empress deigns it important for them to.
Hmm.
You're not awarded clan status unless the empress says, you know what? You did something sweet. In the case of the wolf, they were awarded clan status because Genju and Suichi protected an imperial heir from being attacked by bandits.
Mm-hmm.
And the imperial heir lobbied on their behalf and said, hey, these two saved my life. They deserve something great. They deserve something that goes beyond, up in a, you know, they deserve something that goes above and beyond what would be offered to the average samurai. And because of that, they were allowed to become not only samurai, but the lords of their hometown. And to elevate samurai that they felt were also of note and of merit.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding where your clan fits into the empire and understanding why the empress would elevate them.
Yeah.
Picking a place within the empire that they can exist within that doesn't ruffle the feathers of any of the great clans and either allows them to create a symbiotic relationship or, if you're willing to let them be picked on, allows them to be a useful tool or vassal to another clan.
Yeah.
Another important thing is understanding what allows this clan to make money within the empire.
Mm-hmm.
Because every clan has an economy, and that's going to change the way that the clan exists. Yeah. The Wolf's major imports and exports, because they are a colonially based clan, are it's fruit, vegetables, things that are somewhat exotic to the empire proper that fetch a reasonable price within the empire, as well as service. The Wolf clans sell a lot of their services to other clans, so their services matchmakers, their services bodyguards, their services scouts, because people would rather spend wolf lives than the lives of their own. So what is the cost of a couple of wolves as opposed to the cost of a crane? What is the cost of a couple of wolves as opposed to a crab?
Yep.
Right? Many lords will just say, okay, let's hire them. It's not a big deal.
Mm.
And that's what gives the wolf a place with the empire.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, over the years, I've always been impressed with the level of detail and thought that has gone into the creation of this clan and how well fleshed out it is. And clear, as you said, that it is a passion project for you. Like, you have poured yourself into this clan. So I'm going to ask the hard question. What's your favorite part?
It has changed.
Okay.
My favorite part of the Wolf used to be the Honshu. It used to be their main family. It was my baby. I created it. It was a love letter to my brothers. It was a representation of, my family and my way of life in this thing that I adored. And then I had other people create things in the world that fit into the Wolf. The other three families of the Wolf are a product of other people making characters and presenting them and creating legacies and dynasties and offering themselves to the Wolf. And the leaders of the Wolf just saying, hey, you know what? We will take you in. Hey, you know what? We will accept you. And it's a lot of what my own family was like. My mother and father have always been really loving, accepting people who, if anybody comes into our home, they're immediately family, right? You know, you get a hug, you get a meal, you get told, hey, we're happy to have you here. And it is something that to this day I have tried to make a part of who and what I am. The Kyushu family was brought to me in a way where I didn't initially agree with having the Kyushu as a part of the Wolf Clan. And as time has gone by, I've learned to appreciate it and value it more and more and more. As I've seen other people play Kyushu, as I've seen the way that Kyushu interact with the world and interact in some stories, I'm like, damn, that was an excellent addition. The Orihara, I've had a player, one of my players married the head of the Orihara before they were the Orihara Daimyo. And to watch those two sort of court and woo and go through that experience, and then to create their family out from under that, was an awesome experience. All of these little things that I've gotten to watch people contribute to this story that I will maintain until the end is not my story. What is our story? It's been a blessing, and it continues to be a blessing every time that we sit down at a table and we tell these stories together. And it continues to be a blessing every time that we remind ourselves that we too can be great.
Wow.
Just need to take a pause there. So that's all for this last episode of this series of The Legend of the Five Rings. Make sure to like and comment so we can drive up engagement and spread the word about this great game to other people. It's been a joy and it's been a pleasure to work with both Roman and Steve on this platform here at It's a Mimic, to bring to you guys a couple of details about this amazing world that we've created together and would love for you guys to engage in a world we call the Samurai Sadness Simulator. For more info and details, please check the show notes.
When you're resolved from the beginning, you will not be perplexed. This understanding extends to everything. Be resolved, young samurai, and tell the world what you have witnessed here today.